You are listening to the Post Growth Australia podcast, the one podcast where size don't matter and where better is better than bigger.
Welcome back to PGAP, and we're your hosts, Michael Bayliss and Mark Allen. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Michael. How are you today?
I'm good. We're coming to the end of season five.
That's a bit sad.
There'll be future seasons, and thank you so much, Mark, for being part of the journey of season five that has seen PGAP come from strength to strength, coming up in the world in terms of the listenships and a very supportive community and a suite of mighty fine guests as well.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity. No, I really enjoy doing this.
That's really great, and our past guests seem to really enjoy PGAP too. I've had a lot of contact from previous guests in the first few seasons of PGAP, and Martin Tai, as we know, was in came back on for a special bonus episode last time.
It's always a good sign when they actually still talk to you afterwards. You know, they don't like block you and unfriend you, and you can't ever find them again.
That alone keeps me going. Dr. Alex Bullman, who we had a couple of seasons ago on land use and privatisation and when that fits in with the degrowth movement, he's written a chapter with Dr. Samuel Alexander in the Degrowth Handbook, and he got an article in The Conversation with regards to that. And he's asked me to share a quote from that article, which is, "This obsession with economic growth is destroying our planet, as we all know. We must rethink private ownership of land. That's where it all went wrong."
Yeah, I very much agree. We do need to rethink that. That's a big part of it.
It's certainly playing a big part in the current housing crisis, that's for sure.
A big part of the jigsaw puzzle, yes. It's been interesting as a town planner to look at what Alex has written, and I find it very inspiring.
It's probably worth mentioning that you and I have been very busy with the written word over the last couple of months. If you check the PGAP blog, you will notice quite a few extra articles, and we've also been published in Eco Shout on Medium with Rod Taylor's podcast Rethinking Sustainability.
Yeah, Independent Australia too. Shout out to them. They're a great independent media group. They've published one of our articles,
which is fantastic. So all the more reason to have a couple of months break before we're back with a whole fresh batch of episodes for season six in a couple of months from here. But look, I thought we might end on a bit of a banger.
We should end with a banger.
And our next guest is a hero for both of us, and that is John Seed from the Deep Ecology Movement. Now, Mark, during the interview, you did a great introduction to John Seed himself, but did you want to give us a little bit of an overview of the Deep Ecology Movement?
Yeah, well, deep ecology, I think, is an incredibly important philosophy. We talk a lot about the need for systemic change, the need for degrowth, and or post-growth, should I say, which can include and must include some form of degrowth towards a steady-state society. But we also need to go deeper than that, because the core of our problem is our disconnection from the earth, or our feeling of disconnection from the earth, and our sense of separation from nature, and the way we look at nature as if it's something outside of us. And even modern day conservation is very based around reactive stuff, like unless we solve climate change, we will not have a future for our children and all that kind of thing, which is really, really important. But it's still that sense of nature as being something separate. And yes, it's important, we need to protect nature for our future. But deep ecology takes us back even deeper. And I think we really need to do that, because, you know, it's a bit of a cliche, but I don't think we're going to change the system with the same thinking that actually props this system up. We need to go back to a decolonizing approach to our way of looking at the world. So learning a hell of a lot from First Nations people, for sure, and other ancient cultures and wisdoms. And deep ecology is such an important part of that growing movement for behavioural change. And to summarise it, I'm going to read off Google, because Google can just summarise things better than me. And it says that deep ecology is an environmental philosophy and social movement based in the belief that humans must radically change their relationship to nature from one that values nature solely for its usefulness to human beings to one that recognises that nature has an inherent value. And I think that really does summarise it. But I recommend to look into it and delve into it. And the holistic activism movement that I'm part of is heavily influenced by deep ecology as well. And the two interconnect very well. At least I think they do, and I hope they do.
I think they do connect very well. And what better way to connect with deep ecology than with John Seed, the huge figurehead for the deep ecology movement in Australia. Are you looking forward to this interview, Mark?
I'm really looking forward to it. Hi, John. Thank you so much for coming along and being interviewed on PGAP. We really appreciate it. Thank you.
I'm really glad to be here, Mark. Thank you.
We normally start by asking people to tell us a bit about themselves, but we're going to do something a bit different today. So we're going to kind of do a this is your life type thing by providing a kind of a brief outline of how it all started for you. So I'm going to take you back to 1973, and your path has taken you to becoming a Buddhist, and you have moved to Nimbin in northern New South Wales, and you have founded a meditation centre. And you were living what we would describe today as a kind of a mostly permaculture lifestyle. I'm not sure if the term permaculture had been coined by then. But then in 1979, so a few years later, you suddenly become involved in the very first action ever in Australia and possibly the world to save a rainforest, which happens to be not too far from Nimbin itself in northern New South Wales. And all of a sudden, you find not only an activist, but you become a very successful activist. And you're involved in the ensuing years in other campaigns, which are sort of quite famous and well-known, such as the Franklin River campaign and the Daintree campaign. So that's an incredible time to be around and to be an activist at that historic time. But one thing that I've noticed is these campaigns were very, very successful. We look back. You know, we've now got the Nightcap National Park as a result of the work that you did in those early days protecting that rainforest. And we've got the Franklin River National Park and other areas to show for these actions. Do you think it was easier to succeed as an activist in that era? I mean, are we now up against much more powerful vested interests such as the Atlas Network and other neoliberal think tanks that are sort of making activism so much more difficult?
I do think so. I also think that there are kind of, I would say, waves that appear in human affairs. And I don't really have any explanation, but I know that when we started at Terania Creek in 1979, it was basically 200 hippies against the world. Of course, it was much easier in those days because no one had ever seen people climbing up into the trees in front of the bulldozers or chaining themselves to the machinery. So it was really easy to be the first item on the news night after night and to quickly become visible. But I don't think that that's enough to explain the extraordinary fact that less than 18 months after a standing start, when no one even knew what a rainforest was or that a rainforest existed in Australia, up around Nimbin, it wasn't known as rainforest. It was called the bastard scrub. And there was nothing romantic about it. It was full of leeches and thorns, and it was dank and miserable. And it was really through the campaigns that the concept of rainforest became current. But less than 18 months later, an opinion poll found that more than 70% of the people of New South Wales wanted an end to rainforest logging, and that gave the government of the day the mandate to create a string of national parks that stretched from the border ranges down to Barrington Tops, including the Nightcap National Park that you've mentioned. And the following year, all of the number plates proudly proclaimed New South Wales, the rainforest state.
That's incredible.
So, you know, I'd love to see another one of those waves coming along. And, of course, the opposition would be much more sophisticated than it was in those days, because they've all watched the movies about how we succeeded and would be determined that we wouldn't succeed again, and we'd no doubt have to find completely new tactics and ways of proceeding. But in the absence of such a wave, I'm not really sure, given the vastness of the forces against which we are arrayed, it's difficult to see how something as successful as those days would be possible again.
Yeah, interesting, interesting. And you've talked recently about the power of vested interests, such as the Atlas Network. We seem to have a lot of sort of shadowy, powerful characters working under the surface. Do you have any thoughts around that and how we can tackle that?
This has only really come into focus for me quite recently. I was part of a blockade organised by a wonderful group called Rising Tide, where we blockaded the port of Newcastle in the Hunter River for about 36 hours in November in kayaks. There was 3,000 people there. It was huge. And 109 of us got arrested, including me, first time I've been arrested in a quarter of a century, preventing the coal ships from leaving Newcastle, which, to my astonishment, I find that 1% of all of the greenhouse gases in the world are exported out of the port of Newcastle. So it's the coal that leaves Newcastle has a tremendous impact all over the world, and it's not counted in Australia's carbon budget that counts as part of India's greenhouse gases and so on. And while I was at the blockade, I fell into some bad company and found out about the fact that Extinction Rebellion, the South Australian chapter of Extinction Rebellion, were doing an action in Sydney 2 days later. And I was invited to come along, and I went along, and there in Macquarie Street, Sydney, immediately opposite Parliament House, another nondescript skyscraper full of offices, there were these activists throwing eggs full of paint at the first floor windows and graffitiing the sidewalk and graffitiing the building. And it was to publicise the existence of an organisation called the Centre for Independent Studies. And it was I'd never heard of it, and I'd never heard of the Atlas Network, of which I now understand that the Centre for Independent Studies is one of more than 600 supposedly independent think tanks all over the world that have been created by this Atlas Network, which is funded to the tune of nearly $1 billion a year by the Koch brothers and ExxonMobil and the fossil fuel mafia, deliberately to spread disinformation and to contaminate or corrupt the information landscape to create doubt where absolutely no doubt is feasible any longer in order for their obscene profits to continue into the future.
You know, when an organisation calls itself independent, you almost, that's red alarm bells already, isn't it?
Very true.
Now, we at Postgrowth Australia, we do what we say, we're on the tin. We believe that infinite growth for the finite planet's not a great idea. Like you, you know, we've come to the realisation we're trying to stop overdevelopment for remnant bushland in Albany. But for every forest you save, there you lose 1,000 more.
That's something that John said himself. That's one of your famous quotes.
But a lot of people seem unconvinced that we can have a system other than economic growth. You know, you have that fallacy, well, you need economic growth to have the funding to protect national parks and stuff like that. So, look, it's very, very hard to shift the mainstream narrative. So campaigning for post-growth, it's not enough. We do need to go deeper.
As a Buddhist, did you come to this realization in the early days of your activism, or did you have a sudden epiphany one day that led you into deep ecology? And how did connecting with deep ecology change the way you approach activism?
Well, it feels as though my life has been a kind of a series of epiphanies. And there was, I guess, back in London in the early 70s, I was a systems engineer working for IBM, traveling into the city of London to work on the American Express account and the Rothschilds bank account in a three-piece suit. So the first significant epiphany was LSD, which totally blew that whole life away. And next thing I knew, I was on the road, having left everything behind me. And but that led me to Buddhism. I spent, I guess, 6 or 7 years where that was my primary allegiance or sense of identity. And then just quite mysteriously, I found myself participating in this direct action at Terania Creek. I was only there because some neighbours had appealed for help. I didn't know anything about rainforest, but I knew that I wanted to help the neighbours, so I just showed up on the day. And then something happened to me there, which I'd have to admit was an epiphany, because I felt like the trees were calling out to me and they knew my name. And I was stunned because I didn't have any idea that such a thing was possible. And indeed, I struggled against it for a little while, thinking I was having some kind of a mental breakdown. But it was too beautiful and too compelling and too authentic. And before long, I'd left that whole life behind and run away with the circus of what was going to become the ecological movement. As you mentioned, we went from the success at Terania Creek and Mount Nardi in New South Wales, where we were able to protect the best of the subtropical rainforests, to the Franklin River. We were able to be part of this great campaign that stopped the damming of the Franklin River and the flooding of the temperate rainforest wilderness and another national park. And then the following year, up to the Daintree for the tropical rainforests, where again, a national parks and eventual World Heritage listing rewarded our efforts. But as you said, during that first half of the 80s, for every forest that was protected, 1,000 forests were lost. And clearly, there was no way to protect the planet one forest at a time. That unless we could address the underlying psychological or spiritual disease that allows modern humans to imagine that we can somehow profit from the destruction of our own life support systems, clearly these actions would be of no particular significance as far as the future of the world was concerned. We find ourselves in the middle of an extinction spasm that has, unlike anything that's happened for 65 million years, and saving a little postage stamp national park here and there while the rest of the planet gets developed and tarred over is clearly not going to make any difference to that. And so it was in trying to understand this psychological dimension of the environmental crisis that I came upon the philosophy of deep ecology, where for the first time I felt my questions were being answered, and I felt that I had the next piece of the tapestry that was to become my life.
Yeah, nice. Yeah. Nice. That's great. Thank you. I have found that as scientists give us more dire information about the state of the world, we as a society seem to be going backwards and sort of digging deeper into the ideologies that separate us from all that is. So I, like many others, sort of feel an increasing sense of despondency. And I was wondering, how can we live with grief? I feel so much grief. How can we do that and carry it into our activism? Especially, you know, you read the statistics every day and it's so dire, so depressing. How can deep ecology help us process our grief, carry it into our activism so that we can continue to do work to heal the world?
Well, I guess I'd needed to introduce a little bit of background to answer that. So deep ecology, the term was coined by the late Arne Næss, the professor of philosophy from Oslo University. And according to Næss, underlying all of the symptoms of the environmental crisis lies the illusion of separation between human beings and the rest of the natural world. And that this illusion of separation, he claimed, was a result of anthropocentrism or human-centeredness, the idea that human beings are the center of everything. According to this, we are the crown of creation, we are the measure of all being, we are the only thing that has intrinsic value. All of the rest of nature, the earth itself, only have instrumental value if they are a resource for us. A mistaken view that sees us as being the tip of the pyramid, with all of the rest of creation being there merely to support us, is an alternative view, is the ecological view, where we could say a better metaphor is that the universe is like a vast web and we humans are just one tiny infinitesimal strand in that last web. And as we destroy the other strands, we destroy ourselves. So Ness said that this mistake was so ancient, going back at least as far as the Old Testament, where we learn that man is to subdue and dominate nature and nature is to be in fear and trembling of us. He said, we're not going to be able to think our way out of the mess that's been created. Famously, he said, ecological ideas won't be enough to save us. What we need is ecological identity or ecological self. And he said that in order to nourish that ecological identity, in order to focus on that ecological identity, he said we need community therapies to heal that illusion of separation. And so for some years I went around professing this philosophy of deep ecology, but as Ness said, it was just ideas and ideas won't save us. And it was really only in 1986 when I met my teacher, Joanna Macy, where the next step became clear, because her work, which she then called Despair and Empowerment, we joined that together with the philosophy of deep ecology to begin to create the community therapies that Ness was talking about. Joanna's work, which she now calls Honouring Our Pain for the World, she showed us that we live in a culture of denial, where there's a fear and a denial of many of our feelings. And so in particular, we are never encouraged to feel, let alone share with each other, our deepest feelings of anguish and rage and terror about what's happening to our world. And Joanna said that if we can create a safe container and invite those feelings rather than pushing them away, that this leads to empowerment. And she taught us how to create such a container. And this became the basis, along with the ideas of deep ecology, of what are now the experiential deep ecology workshops. Joanna's now 95, so she's retired, but until recently she has kept doing that for nearly 40 years. And I've got another two workshops coming up later this month. It's central to my work. So what Joanna showed us was that these feelings that we've been taught to fear, they're in fact a really important part of our intelligence, that if we look back upon our evolutionary history, then we realize that over the last 4,000 million years, every single one of our ancestors has been intelligent enough to reach the age of reproducing itself before it was consumed, without a single exception. What an extraordinary pedigree for each of us. And yet 99.999999% of that intelligence preceded our cognition, that it's only very recently that we've started to think our way through the world. And what we call feelings, what remains in us of this ancient intelligence that unerringly guided endless generations of ancestors to make good decisions about what was safe and what was dangerous, when to run towards something and when to run away from something. We can call it intuition, we can call it instinct, it doesn't matter what you call it. What we call feelings is what remains of that primal ancient intelligence that, unlike cognition, has stood the test of time. When we suppress those feelings, not only are we suppressing that intelligence, but these feelings are pushing up with a tremendous, naturally selected energy, and a huge and equal and opposite energy is required of social conditioning to push the feelings back down again. And so a tremendous amount of our life force is squandered in this futile battle between instinctual forces and social conditioning. And what remains after that is just a sense of helplessness and hopelessness and what can one person do anyway, and it's all too late and like that. But what Joanna taught us and what I continue to teach is that when we create a safe container that invites those feelings, when we invite people to share and to listen to each other's pain for the world, the pain that we feel when we look at what's happening to our world, that the upshot of that is all of that energy is released and becomes available to us, and we experience it as empowerment. All of a sudden, there's a kind of an excitement in the air, and people are planning their next move rather than feeling paralyzed, rather than feeling disempowered and lost. So what we need to do with those feelings is to schedule them in. So I've decided, for example, that on Saturday week, I'm going to be in Ballingen at a workshop called Deep Ecology. And on Saturday morning, 35 of us will sit in a circle and I'll introduce honoring our pain for the world. And then there will be tremendous amount of noise of wailing and gnashing of teeth and howling and beating of, you know, hands against pillows and so on. And at the end of it, when the dust settles, this extraordinary sense of liberation and empowerment ensues, and then we can begin to plan how we're going to tackle whatever piece of the problem each of us is going to address.
This is such important work, John. I honestly don't think we can turn this ship around without deep ecology and other narratives that align with it. So, you know, it feels like the pressure's on, so to speak. Do you have any ideas about how you can get deep ecology more into the mainstream? And do you feel that, importantly, that the movement is growing? Do you feel that when you do workshops, there are potential people in those workshops who may go off and run workshops of their own down the track?
I faced a couple of life-threatening illnesses not so long ago. And so for several years, I had nothing else to do other than stay alive. I was close to death on a number of occasions. And when I came back and when my energy returned, to my delight, I found that I was interested in exactly what I'd been interested in before, the conservation of nature and deep ecology. But something had changed, because whereas for more than 30 years I'd been offering these workshops and there'd always been an enthusiastic small number of people who are interested, I would characterize them as like environmentalists, hippies, pagans, and witches were the people who were attracted to the workshops. And I always wanted to, have the CEO of the multinational corporations coming along, but somehow they never did. So I've just had to be at peace with reality. You can't really argue against reality. And so I just had to deal with the reality. But all of a sudden, 2 or 3 years ago, when I came back into this work, I found that the workshops were filling up, and they were filling up with a lot more young people. They were filling up with techies and teachers and public servants and so on. And so then I began to feel like if this were the start of a virtuous J-curve, unlike all of the other J-curves, this is the one that we want to see, where deep ecology was spread like fire around the world, I would very, very quickly lose any ability to keep up with it. And so I started to invite 2 or 3 people to co-facilitate with me at each workshop. That's been happening. So I've now had probably 60 people who are facilitators of this work. The J-curve hasn't continued the way that I had hoped, but it is growing in a much more modest kind of a way. And I haven't got any better ideas, other than I'm looking for help with social media, because I'd like to see whether social media can help spread deep ecology. And I'm really interested in podcasts, because I spend a lot of time listening to podcasts myself, and I feel like that this is the new medium whereby a good idea could conceivably spread very, very quickly from podcast to podcast, so to say. I'll have to say that if I look at the evidence of how quickly deep ecology is spreading and then multiplied it by several orders of magnitude, it still wouldn't be enough to make any difference. And so the way that I look at it, nothing short of a tremendous miracle of a fundamental revolution in human consciousness sweeping the world in no time at all would be enough to save us. And so one might therefore give up in despair. But from a deep ecology perspective, being descended from fish that learned to walk on the land and having survived ages of ice and having survived six extinction spasms already, including the one at the end of the Permian when fully 95% of all of the species of that time became extinct. But our ancestors, yours and mine, didn't, you know, and we're here to tell the tale. You know, living in a world that is so littered with miracles, it's not over till it's over. And I got nothing better to do, you know, like than to throw myself heart and soul into the best that I can do. Do you know the story of the 100 monkeys, the 100th monkey? Have you heard that story?
Reminders.
It's like apparently scientists were studying some macaque monkeys in on an island in Japan, and they were feeding the monkeys sweet potatoes in order to get them to gather together. And at a certain, they left the sweet potatoes on the beach. And at a certain point, one of the young monkeys, a young female monkey, took the sweet potato and took it into the water and washed the sand off it before she ate it. Soon thereafter, some of her peers, other young monkeys, learned how to do that. And at a certain point, when enough monkeys were cleaning the sweet potatoes of sand before they ate them, overnight, the entire community of monkeys learned how to do that. And the theory is that when there are 99 monkeys, nothing happens, but when the 100th monkey learns how to do it, then it sweeps through the whole of the society. And so I bring that up saying, when I say I've got nothing better to do, I feel like, wouldn't it be terrible to discover that there had been 99 monkeys and I hadn't shown up? You know, like, so I'm showing up in the hope that 99 other monkeys show up and that somehow between us we can pull this off.
That's great. And also, the way I also see it as well is that caring for the planet is our actual nature. So to say I'm going to stop caring for the planet because there's no hope means that we're denying our true nature by giving up hope and becoming part of the problem. Even if we don't succeed, I still feel that our true nature is always going to be to care, and we must always hold that sacred no matter what the outcome.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I agree.
Thank you so much for talking about it in that way as well. It really helps me to sort of look at those issues.
How to turbocharge behavioural change in a short amount of time is always a million-dollar question, and one that we've, you know, raised on this podcast thousands of times. I suppose the best answer we've come up with is putting MDMA in the tap water, but that's a bit hard to put through ethics. So in the meantime, we have to try and find alternative solutions too. Now, look, you were involved in a very successful campaign to end the clearing of land to produce cattle for Burger King in Costa Rica. Now, Costa Rica is very close to my heart. I wrote an article a few years ago about countries that are bucking the norm of the GDP at all costs, and got to speak with the then ambassador of Costa Rica in Canberra. I was just really impressed by the things that the Costa Ricans have done over the decades, like really good family planning programs, dedicating so much to land, to national parks, their outlook on life, you know, pura vida, pure life is one of the catchphrases, decommissioning the military. You know, obviously it's not without its problems, but he's, you know, rightfully extremely proud of the direction his country's going in. Do you think that your work had a ripple effect that has led to this, and how can we make it so the act of saving one forest can lead to a change of events that enable 1,000 to be saved? And I think that comes back to the 100 monkeys thing, doesn't it?
I've got no reason to believe that our actions had anything to do with that. I love what's happened in Costa Rica, and I love what they're doing. You know, what we did was so important in its own right, and perhaps it was part of creating the conditions that made other things possible, but that wouldn't be visible to me. It was a really interesting campaign because it turned out that most of the rainforest destruction that was happening in the mid-80s in Central America was the result of clearing for cattle pasture, because it would drop a few cents off the price of a hamburger in the United States to grow the beef there rather than grow it in the United States. And it turned out that a single company, Burger King, was responsible for all of the rainforest destruction, practically all the rainforest destruction happening in Costa Rica. And so I was doing a series of roadshows around the United States where I was traveling with a radical environmental organization called Earth First. And when we discovered this, we decided we'd have a roadshow in May of 1986, which we called Whopper Stopper Month, because the Burger King's hamburger was called a Whopper, and we would go to a different city every night. We sometimes would drive for 800 kilometres in between gigs, and we'd set up and give a presentation about the successes that we'd had in Australia. We'd show the film Earth First, a very inspiring story of Terania Creek, Franklin River, Daintree, and the successes that we had there. We showed that. And then we told people about Burger King and invited the audience to join us after the show, and we'd do a demonstration outside a Burger King hamburger joint where we had a paper mache and cloth cow and banners and placards, and the cow would be eating rainforest leaves in one end and shitting whoppers out onto the pavement out the other end. And this was very interesting for people. Like, television came and it spread, you know, the news spread very, very quickly because it was such an amusing kind of an image. And over May 1986, Burger King's share price, for some reason or other, dropped by 11%. And at the end of that month, they announced that they would henceforth only use domestic beef and grow all of their hamburgers in the United States. And so, again, it was just like an incredible example of, well, whether we had anything to do with the what happened to their share price, well, no one will ever know, but certainly Burger King got spooked. The result is that the rainforest destruction in Costa Rica stopped, and the very positive scenario that that you described, Michael, was ensued, which is kind of an example to the Americas now.
Yeah, oh, I really hope so. And this idea of the ripple effect, so when we do our activism and we send out ripples and we don't necessarily know where those ripples are going to go and how much they're going to have, those are some of the things that keep me going. Obviously, as an activist, I'm constantly having to deal with disappointment. But I think maybe something that I've said and something that I've done might have set something in motion that creates something that I'll never know for sure, but might have made an impact, you know. And for me, that's one of the things that keeps me going. What I love about your work is that you're doing this, the behavioural stuff and the systemic stuff, but you're still working, excuse the pun, on the coalface, so to speak, of the direct action and the reactive stuff. And very recently, you were involved, that you talked about earlier, the Rising Tide blockade, and it was your first arrest for many years. Could you tell us a bit more about that? Obviously, you live very close to Newcastle, and you say how important it is that we really raise awareness of just how much carbon we're exporting out of Newcastle. And so it's obviously a really pertinent campaign.
I was very excited to see the quality of the work that the organising work that Rising Tide were doing. An organisation of that name has existed for, I don't know, 10 or 15 years, and they've done these blockades of Newcastle Harbour in the past, but a new group of people got together and resurrected it after it had disappeared for a time, and they just did it very, very beautifully and attracted 3,000 people along to that action, and it's very colourful. People had, you know, constructed floating devices of every kind, you know, huge rafts built out of, you know, like plastic or drums and so on, unicorns, all kinds of things. In the end, 109 of us got arrested, and it was interesting that the police minister of New South Wales commended us, saying how important it was for people to, you know, raise awareness in whatever way they could. And the magistrates were very, very lenient. A lot of people didn't even get a conviction. Nothing more serious happened to anyone than I think a $600 fine was the largest penalty. And so it almost seems as though the authorities themselves are looking for help to, it's like in New South Wales back in 1979, we spoke to the Premier, Neville Rann, and he said in confidence off the record that nothing would make him happier than to stop the logging and to save the rainforest. But it was up to us to create the public opinion that would give him a mandate to do that. That until then, his only job was to keep the Conservatives out of power, and that if we would only create that groundswell, he would be delighted to create the legislation. And I'm sort of getting the feeling that, you know, there's this great line in a Leonard Cohen song where he speaks of the widowhood of every government. And if you think that of the government as a widow, who died? And to me, the answer seems to be the citizen, that the citizen has died. And in the absence of citizenship, in the absence of a kind of a robust democratic demand from the people, the government's kind of powerless against the vested interests, against Murdoch, against the fossil fuel mafia, against the $1 billion of disinformation that the Atlas Network and their minions are spreading. And so I almost feel as though they're trying to kind of just quietly encourage us to try and create that mandate, because no one is going to profit from this situation. You know, that we're watching the demise of our civilization, in my opinion, and that's not in anyone's interest, but somehow we're all just feeling paralyzed. We're all just stuck in whatever job we find ourselves in and so on. And it's, you know, and so there's just a few people who somehow have the freedom to really stand up and to try to sound the alarm and to make a difference. And I feel that the opposition to us doing that may be lessening, you know. Anyway, Rising Tide are determined to have 10,000 people there this November, and I'll certainly be among them. And they had an organising retreat, organising for their campaign for this year, and they invited me to come along in order to do the despair and empowerment work there, because they understand that this is burnout proofing their activists, that, you know, the risk of burnout is probably the single biggest obstacle to continued activism, because as you say, we're faced with such dismal kind of prospects, and the news is so bad that it's very difficult without the kind of psychological or spiritual tools that Joanna Macy created. In my opinion, it's very difficult to go on in the face of all of that bad news unless we can somehow perform jujitsu and take the energy of the bad news and transform it into our own empowerment.
That's great. And it's a real pertinent reminder about why nonviolent direct action is still really, really important, and also why we need to stand up to growing anti-protest laws that are starting to happen around the world. I noticed that the United Kingdom are increasingly doing that. So we need to watch that as well, because that's one of the techniques of groups like the Atlas Network, who will try and push for anti-protest laws, because as you say, it is crucial that we continue to go out there and protest. And I think it's great as well that you're bringing deep ecology, the sort of the proactive stuff, in amongst the reactive stuff as well. So you create that lovely, as you say, that resilience. You create a more resilient type of activism. That's really, really heartening to hear. And then when you're not doing the direct action and when you're not doing the workshops, you're still being an activist of sorts because you're living on an eco-village and you're kind of part of the growing movement for a different type of living. So yeah, back in the early 70s, you were living in an eco-community in Nimbin called Bodhi Farm. And today you are living on a eco-village called Narara on the central coast of New South Wales, which we touched on briefly earlier. And now, of course, you are, living what we would now coin as the permaculture lifestyle. We actually have a word for it now, and you're growing shiitake mushrooms. And my background's in town planning, so I find this kind of thing very interesting. I was wondering, are there many similarities between your early days living in a community in Nimbin compared to what you're doing today on a more kind of organized, I guess, more planned eco-community? Do you think that Narara is a good example of how we could create communities down the track?
I do think Narara is a good example of that. The founder of Narara Eco Village, Lyndall Paris, right from the word go, she described it as a demonstration eco village. That basically, she sees this as being something that is potentially scalable, and that if we can make it work here, like basically, if you can make an eco village work in Gosford, you can make it work anywhere in the country. Much as I loved the kind of wild hippie freedom of my earlier days and the kind of ways that we created social change back then, there's something about building this thing. Like, I believe that it's not long before everybody is going to have to live more frugally and have to live in harmony with the constraints of biology of the earth. So I think that what we're creating, the model that we're creating at Narara, is one that is not a big stretch for most people in Australia. That, as you drive in, some of the houses look a little bit different, but basically it's not that different to the Bogan suburb outside the gates. And yet we're using a quarter of the energy and we're producing it all ourselves. And all of the houses are linked together in a smart grid. And, but it's kind of invisible. There's no way that Australia is willingly going to turn into Nimbin. But it could easily be happy to turn into the Narara Eco Village. We made huge changes to the society from Nimbin, and these continue to this day. But I'm thinking in particular that Bodhi Farm, we built our houses illegally using scrounged and salvaged material, and the local government, they knew what we were doing, but I think they secretly admired it, and they thought it reminded them of their grandparents and how their grandparents were pioneers and settlers. And it was only after they discovered that we were participating in the in stopping the logging that they sent in the building inspector. And so, like a few weeks after the Terania Creek blockade started, there were 20 demolition orders on our houses at Bodhi Farm. And we fought those using the same kinds of organising tactics and media tactics that we were learning in the forest campaigns. And by the time that the case of the demolition, our appeal against the demolition orders reached the Supreme Court, which it eventually did, we had won the battle for the forests and we were heroes. I joked recently that, I was arrested for blockading the forests, and I prepared this defence called the defence of necessity. I pleaded not guilty, and they went and dropped the charges, declared the Nightcap National Park, and gave me an OAM. Instead of proceeding with the charges against me. And so it was like, by the time the issue of our houses reached the Supreme Court, the mood had changed. And the government legislated with what's called multiple occupancy zoning. And as a result, people are allowed to live in communities. There is now a legal framework that allows people to live in communities that didn't exist before. And had we lobbied for such a legal framework, we would have got nowhere at all. But because our houses were being demolished and we were on the front page of the paper, you know, all of these beautiful houses and babies in our arms and so on. And we enrolled on the housing commission. You know, you can demolish our houses and then you'll have to find public housing for us or we'll be homeless, you know. And all of those things made it possible for the government to then create the multiple occupancy zoning, which to this day allows communities to persist. And so it's not that those early communities weren't responsible for a huge amount of social change, but it was very different than the social change that I think is going to grow out of the communities that are being built today.
That's very interesting. That's a good history of how we got from the Nimbin days to here. Thank you so much.
Now we're at the last question now, John. Now, all good things must come to an end. One of those is our parasitic capitalist economy. And another thing that must come to an end is our conversation. But did want to end on a musical note. Mark and I also write songs based on environmental concerns. And it was a delight to go through your discography on SoundCloud in the past week, and we're going to play one of your songs, which is an incredible one, I think, recorded back in the early 90s, called World Bank Song, with many themes that are still relevant. Would you like to explain a little bit more about that song and your musical journey?
Well, I mean, when you approached me, I was really attracted to the title of your podcast as post-growth, that this is very much what we need. And it reminded me of that that part of my work, which I would think of as being a criticism of the current economic paradigms, you know. And I wrote an article, which perhaps you can put a link to, or people can easily find it if they put my name in, and the title of the article, which is The Religion of Economics. And so in this article, I proposed that economics is not a science, but is a religion, and it's based upon totally ridiculous religious tenets, such as infinite growth is possible on a finite planet, which you started this program with. And the World Bank song is the critique of those institutions which are destroying the world in their attempts to keep growing. What happened was that, again, this back in the 80s, we received an invitation from a group in Washington, D.C. called the Environmental Defense Fund to join their campaign. They were putting together an international campaign to reform the environmental policies of the World Bank and the other multilateral development banks. And as we learned about those, the full horror of what it was that these institutions were inflicting upon the world in the name of development became apparent to us. And out of that grew the song, which I'd be really interested if, I don't know whether you heard the song or whether you saw the clip that we made. There's a video clip that goes with the song, but once again, I would love it if you could put a link in the show notes to the video clip, because much as I like the song, I'm really proud of the video that we put together to go along with it.
We did see the video clip. It was incredible and very, very punchy. Really complimented a fantastic song to begin with. So we'll be delighted, John, to close this episode with playing your song. Thank you so much. You've been an inspiration for the both of us. And it was absolutely wonderful when you said yes to be interviewed, and your insights continue to inspire us. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, John. We really, really appreciate it. It means so much. It really does. Thank you.
Emanating from expensive business suits, do you notice odors foul and rank? With his ecocide, genocide numbers game, here comes the World Bank. vampire needle dripping down the clutching his structural adjustment knife. Ecosystem after system is plundered and led to waste is from the earth. He sucks the life. Deeply vital organs from the living world, spitting out cellulose chips. How generous he freezes all his minions on his carving ecological collapse. Economists from hell smooth the way when interference curling all your fears. With administrators, bureaucrats just doing my job, and all those damn engineers. World Bank's got an evil junkie wife, goes by the name of IMF. Shoots at biological diversity, dispenses cultural death. Mumbling about sustainable development, she plies her vicious trade. And if you see her come for your life, there's an S on the end of her name. Asian, African, American development banks are World Bank's ugly cronies three. With their friends, the scumbag loggers from the FAO and the mafia from the UNDP. They loot the biological register with their tropic forest action plan. Scorch earth, transmigration, chemicals, agribusiness, logging mines and dams. Propping up corrupt third world elites, choke the rivers with the endless dams. Keeping all them foreign experts employed with their paid for by your taxes scams. Rape the earth to meet the interest payments, it's that same old shell game. Centuries of exploitation, and they still owe us. Colonialism by another name. The time has come to clean up this town. Name names, flush out those crooks. Biological fabric and tatters. The World Bank crooks the books. Wake up now, won't you hear the cries of this planet, of your birth? Expose the light. No compromise in defense of Mother Earth. I said stop the lies, no compromise in defense of Mother Earth.
You are listening to Post Growth Australia podcasts, and we just spoke with John Seed from the Deep Ecology Movement, as well as his brilliant song, the World Bank song. And I think it's just absolutely great when activists also do music, topical songs, and we get an absolute joy of supporting and playing music done by our very esteemed guests.
Yeah, it's been a while since we played a song, so that was really good. Really enjoyed that. And another thing, we didn't get a chance to talk about every part of John's history as an environmentalist, so there'll be a link to his website in the show notes as well, so you can learn more about his amazing life and what he's done.
Definitely. And I just also wanted to do a shout out to our fantastic and ever-growing PGAP community. The PGAP community is one of the few things we do want to see growing. Yeah, you've been an amazing support, and we're going to take a little bit of a sojourn over the next 2 months. Mark, I'll look very forward to seeing you at the Sustainable Population Australia Public Forum in Adelaide towards the end of April. And given that Spar support this podcast, we should make a celebrity appearance too. In the meantime, in our absence, you can continue to support PGAP, and you can do that by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts or your favourite podcast platform. You can subscribe There's a subscribe button on the PGAP website. You can contact us with your ideas for future guests and future topics. Last but definitely not least, you can share this and other episodes of PGAP with your friends, family, and networks, because PGAP will never be bought and sold, unlike most of the mainstream media these days. And so thus, we rely not on Rupert Murdoch, but the word of mouth from you lovely people.
Indeed, this is very true. And talking about Sustainable Population Australia, we have written a blog on population, haven't we?
We have a link in the show notes.
Yes, and also a shorter article that summarises the blog, which just explains where me and Michael are at on the issue, and hopefully it's very nuanced and very connects to a wider, deeper context.
Yes. Mm. You know, they say too much nuance is barely enough, but it's been an exhausting time the last couple of months with all the written word stuff, so all the more reason to take a little break.
I'm going to go all zen and just be in a state of deep meditation. I wish.
Deep meditation for deep ecology.
Yeah, well, we definitely need to be going down the path of deep ecology. There's no doubt.
Well, until a couple of months, Mark, until then.
Until then.